weather today in the Grand.
I love you so badly, I could.
They're solid plastic, so don't settle for imitation.
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Good evening, this is Emma Riley, and this is the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. You give us 83 minutes and we'll give you 83 minutes of words. Tonight's double feature episode asks who will survive this episode and what will be left of them. From November 10, 2010, a pairing of Toby Hooper's 1975 classic, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Kim Henkel's 1994, not classic, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation.
Everybody, welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name's Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And this episode is a special look at Texas Chainsaw series, specifically the first one, which is a good movie, and the fourth one, which is a not-so-good movie. And the reason we chose these two is because, well, A, Texas Chainsaw, the original, is probably my favorite horror movie, and Andrew hadn't seen it before. And we went with the fourth one for the bad one because even though Chainsaw 3 is pretty bad and the recent remakes are also pretty bad, the fourth one has the weird distinction of being written and directed by Kim Henkel, the co-writer of the original, which, along with its director, Toby Hooper. And it's got Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger, and that's hilarious. But we're going to start talking about the first one. You know, I've seen this movie, man, well over a dozen times.
And of course, my history with the movie is...
like you told me once about how you didn't get through it. Like, you got as far as the hitchhiker scene where they pick up a weird hitchhiker and then you have to bail out.
Yeah, I was, I'm guessing I was 15 or 16, and it was during some summer where I'd, you know, rent 5 movies and stay up all night and watch them. Mm-hmm. And this was the last movie, and I waited till the morning, birds are chirping, sun's up. I mean, just, I'd heard that it wasn't gory, but it was scary as all hell, and uh-huh. I'd always wanted to see it because even before knowing that I should see it, it was very big in this 80s movie called Summer School, and I was always wondering what they were talking about. So,
you know, so yeah, okay, finish. Yeah, finish first.
So I watched it until the point where they pick up the hitchhiker. And I mean, I remember that part vividly, and then I was like, I can't do this. And I shut it off and I went to bed and I never watched it. And I just assumed that at some point in the future, I would go back to it. And for this podcast, it forced me to get over my fear of mm-hmm. it, which I find interesting that what I remember is the hitchhiker, because it must have really affected me, because, I mean, the beginning of the movie is incredibly disturbing, with the flesh-eaten hands, too. And yeah. I didn't remember that. I was watching it this time going, did they add that? Is it like, you know, one of these, they went back and filmed something and threw it in? Like, they keep doing
this. Is this the version you've never seen?
Yeah, so, but no, I mean, I assume it was there, because that's part of what makes the movie so scary.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's my history with it. And then I remember when we even talked about this, I was hesitant to even do it. So.
Yeah. Well, the first half of the movie is really unparalleled as far as setting up dread and suspense and a sense of doom, starting right with the close-ups of the rotting bodies, basically. That's something that I think Tobe Hooper is really one of his greatest strengths, is creating an atmosphere. He's not so much about the actually creating an atmosphere, and then the opposite of creating an atmosphere, like just being totally visceral and going for the kind of the roller coaster ride. That's what Chainsaw is. It's like the first half is you're going slowly up to the top of the roller coaster, and then like once the final girl, Sally, Marilyn Burns, starts getting chased by Leatherface, I mean, she pretty much spends the whole second half of the movie screaming at the top of her lungs, and it doesn't really let up. It just builds and builds and builds builds speed as it's going downhill. And there's the first studio movie he did, or I guess the first major studio movie he did, was only his third theatrical movie. It was called The Funhouse, and it was made for Universal in 1981. And it kind of gets pegged as like a slasher movie, but it's got a lot more in common with Chainsaw. I mean, Chainsaw is an easier movie to call a slasher movie because, after all, people get killed with a chainsaw.
But very graphically.
No. And The Funhouse doesn't really have graphic violence either. And also, like Chainsaw, practically its entire first is just setting up a weird atmosphere of this carnival. And in Chainsaw, it's just the weird atmosphere of the back roads of southern Texas and old farmhouses and old local drunks babbling to themselves, things like that. Did you think it was do you think it was scary even like once the actual carnage starts happening? Because I can imagine how intense that would have been for people, you know, at the time not used to it, because it's just so relentless. But I guess there aren't a lot of movies now that are willing to just, like, you know, keep the action going more or less nonstop.
I'm trying to think. Are there any real-time... I mean, it's not real-time. It's an abbreviated real-time. But it does take place over one night without any setup. The setup is a half hour or 15 minutes before the bad stuff starts happening. And it seems like, I don't know about the, Saw's in real time, the first one, right?
I haven't seen any of those movies.
Oh, okay. What about Hostel? Are those real time-ish?
Oh, Hostel. More or less, yeah.
So I think that,
And they, Hostel also went for a, like, you know, but, very mint, no real violence or death for the first half, and then the second half just keep going.
Yeah, so...
Except it's not well directed.
How dare you! you don't see that anymore, and so in this situation, seeing sort of a slasher movie that unfolds, I mean, some of it seems like the budget, but the way Hooper is able to use his budget is probably the most brilliant use of no money that, you know, anybody can think of. But no, I think as soon as the killings do start, with the first guy who, Bill Vail, the movie star looking guy, he has such an it's a drawn out sequence when he gets killed. He's looking around the house, it's freaky, and then he notices all the animal heads.
Yeah, in the back room, and he hears a weird animal noise.
And Hooper's shooting this from the front porch, so you've got it. You're looking into the house. You've been in the house, looking around a little, but you're basically, then you just see Vale walk into the back, and sort of Leatherface comes out, smacks him, and then it sort of starts. And I think that it's now then the next girl is the one who gets hung on the meat hook.
Right.
And so at that point, he establishes that there could be these incredibly graphic sort of scenes. There really aren't, but you're expecting them now. So I think that until you get to the point of Marilyn Burns' first escape, to the point she gets to the gas station, barbecue shack, the level of intensity is still at a rise. I think that they don't lose any. I don't think he loses anything by having the killing start. I don't think he loses anything by the somewhat extended sequence of Franklin getting killed. I mean, Franklin takes longer to kill than anybody else. And the funny thing about that is if you haven't seen the movie, Franklin is the disabled guy. And I don't really know that many movies have this. But he's this obnoxious disabled guy. And he, you know, the movie does play, you know, make him sympathetic and everything, but I sort of took it to be that we were supposed to be so horrified that we would care that Franklin got killed, and he has the most lengthy sort of chainsaw death. He's the only real chainsaw death, and yeah, Leatherface finds him and sort of starts sawing at him, non-graphically. I mean, it's a dark, and it's like a three shot, and you can't really see. I don't think there are any close-ups of blood or anything.
No.
But
you see a little blood fly, but you don't see a chainsaw going into a person at all.
Yeah, so I mean that's just in somebody in the viewer's mind, you know, the chainsaw.
And the movie's very good at that. You don't see when the girl gets put on the meat hook, there's no hook going into a fake back
and
or anything.
I remember during that scene, I was waiting for, since I, you know, had never gotten that far into the movie before, and I really had never read any reviews of it except the Maltin review, which is, you know, 100 and probably 90 words or something, and telling me that it's very scary but not gory. And that scene where he puts the girl on the meat hook, they cut it at exactly the right moment before it would be too much. It would, before it sort of descends into the, what do they call it now? Torture porn.
Yeah.
Even though they're not supposed to, because whatever. I mean, the term is sort of main pop culture nonsense. But
it's just that. I mean, you know, she gets hung on the hook, and Leatherface does something, and the scene's over about 30 seconds after she gets put on the hook. I think if Eli Roth had directed it, it would be 30 minutes.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just, the cut is just perfect because it's like, it does not, at this point in the movie, there's no, I don't really think there is any suggestion of some sort of misogynistic bent to it that you find in most slasher movies to some degree.
Yeah, well, you know, like you said, the first victim's a guy, and, I think there's actually an equal.
I think there are three guys.
Yeah, three guys get it, and only one girl gets it.
But I mean, even at the end, it's like when Marilyn Burns is held prisoner by the psycho family, it's never sexualized.
There's a feminist film critic who's actually a man, if you can believe that, named Robin Wood. You know, I guess with a name like that, you got to be a feminist. But he had a good point about chainsaw, or a nice observation, which is the one you just made, that it's never sexualized. And that's kind of really different from, people sort of look to Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho as like the birth of the grandfather of modern slasher movies, or maybe the great grandfather, and then like Chainsaw as the grandfather. But, the difference between Chainsaw and Psycho is that, I mean, they're both based on Ed Gein, too, of course, the guy who, you know, kept his dead mom in his house and, like Norman Bates, and wore human skin like the Chainsaw family, or like Leatherface. But the violence in Chainsaw is never sexualized. And they're quite explicit about that, because at one point Marilyn Burns says, you know, I'll do anything you want, just let me go. And they just mock her because they're totally not interested in that.
Yeah, which makes it, you know, about 1,000 times creepier.
Yeah, they're sort of like children who haven't quite hit puberty yet.
Yeah, this movie probably, if I were the state of Texas, I would do whatever I could to make sure people were not allowed, like, you know, to see it I was thinking about moving business there. See, I mean, at one point during the movie, I was just thinking that, like, I never want to go to Texas. I don't care if it was made in 1972. I never want to go. Because that's the other thing is that it's not just creepy because of the family. I mean, one of the guys in the family was a perfectly normal Texan, you know, 45 minutes before you found out that he was, you know, feeding people human meat at his barbecue stand. And it's like, he seemed more normal than other people there. And at the beginning, it's creepy enough because you meet all these guys. The setup of the movie is that there have been grave robberies in Texas, which we find out is the really stupid one in the family.
The hitchhiker.
The hitchhiker is like digging up bodies for some reason. And it's never really explained why, because it's not like he could really eat the meat, you know?
Yeah, he just enjoys taking pictures of them and rearranging the sculpture.
Yeah, so... And that sculpture is really freaky at the beginning and that sort of thing. But the teenagers, or whoever they are, the stupid teenagers of this movie, who are kind of hippie-ish Texas.
They got long hair, bell bottoms. The girl reads from an astrology book.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you could say they're from Austin, right?
That's the
only place in Texas where that would be allowed. So they're going to check on their grandparents' graves or their grandfather's, and then since they're in town, they go and find the grandfather's old house. And that's when all the trouble starts, because it turns out that the neighbors right behind him are the Chainsaw family. And what's cool about this is earlier than... I don't know when... I guess I always think of it as a Nightmare on Elm Street thing, where they have this need to build some sort of mythology into the movie. I just see that if this had been made by Wes Craven 15 years later, he would have made a big point about the grandfather somehow knowing the Chainsaw family in the past and that sort of thing. None of that's here. It's just, it starts, it goes, it stops. Yeah, like... And I mean, the movie doesn't even have an ending. It's crazy. I mean, you never...
Yeah, well, lots of people have compared this to being like a, you know, the graininess of the film and its dinginess gives it a verite feeling, or a document, or, you know, you're watching... Or industrial accident footage, or
and what's so
blood
amazing
on the highway or something.
How great Hooper's composition is! I mean, it's lovely. It's lovely composition. The scene where they pick up the hitchhiker is one of those great sort of two-dimensional cars driving along the road scenes. The scene on the porch with the swing before the first two murders.
You know what it is about those two shots? It's like Hooper's so great at having, you know, with this movie, it's like it does feel somewhat real. Like it does feel like they just stuck a handheld camera into the back of a van with these hippies. And it's a lot like that, you know, when they're doing other stuff, but then, like, suddenly it'll just cut to this really delicately composed shot, like, when the van pulls over and picks up the hitchhiker. It's a giant wide shot, and just after Bill Vail gets clocked by Leatherface, and it cuts back to his girlfriend outside, like, and she walks towards the house, suddenly the camera is, like, way down at her feet, looking up this really ultra low angle, and the house just looms over her as she walks towards it, and that just makes it like even more shocking when these delicately composed master shots come out of nowhere, because they're in the thick of this, you know, really rapidly edited, almost documentary looking footage.
Yeah, and I mean, it suffers, the composition suffers in the second half once he sort of loses the daylight, just because, you know, it's a low budget. He can't do those kinds of shots in the middle of nowhere in the forest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also,
like, at the dinner table, like, that's a real house that they were shooting in. He can't just put the camera wherever he wants to. He has to be shooting in a real cramped room with all these people.
The dinner scene. Before the dinner scene, I did want to touch on that. The thing about it is that it's not like you're taking, actually, what you just said about the handheld camera. Now, is that Leatherface, the remake, the next relaunch, is it going to be 3D handheld camera
You know, that wouldn't be the worst thing, because the handheld 3D in Jackass 3D was surprisingly engaging. Something about 3D. Yeah, really. I mean, because handheld video camera stuff usually has a big depth of field, and that's what 3D benefits from.
So, but... I mean, that could be the next one, except it would have to be a... I think it should be in the future, because they've already done... The remake was a period piece, right?
Yeah, which was idiotic, yeah.
Well, of course, but still, I mean, you know, they ought to...
Yeah, it was a period piece.
Yeah, shoot it to the future. Let's go 3D handheld future, or like far past, set it in the 1800s.
Well, they couldn't do it in the far past, but, I mean...
Oh, because of the chainsaw.
Right, but in the future you could have, like, a laser saw or something.
Oh, you could have a laser saw. In the past, you could have a homemade chainsaw, like a steam engine chainsaw.
A steam-powered chainsaw.
A steam-powered chainsaw. The cook could also be a technical genius, and we could actually owe him, like, something. That's what the finale could be, is that we find out that it's really the inventor of the...
And that man was Eli Whitney.
There you go. But anyway, so... The teenagers. It's not like they're smart. It's not like they're particularly likable. They kill off the most likable two teenagers. They're the first two to get it. The movie star-looking guy, Bill Vail, who apparently is a set decorator now. He's the only one who looks like a movie star in the whole movie. And his girlfriend. They're both fine. They're not annoying at all. I guess the next guy, Marilyn Burns' boyfriend, isn't annoying. But then we kick off the wonderful scene with the siblings fighting. And...
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's funny, like, I think a lot of people don't like Franklin, and I don't know, I think that was Hooper's intention. I think he has said that in interviews and stuff, but I never found Franklin that annoying. Like, I guess I mostly felt sorry for him being in a, I mean, the first thing we see happening to him is him, like, rolling down a hill in his wheelchair and falling out of it. So, like, right away, he's just kind of pathetic and, you know, he has my sympathy.
So annoying! He's so annoying. I understand that they're awful to him.
And all the awful stuff happens to him. Like, Hitchhiker cuts his hand before they throw him out. And then after...
Oh, yeah, that was weird how long they wait. Yeah.
And then after they've thrown him out and, like, you know, Franklin's squeezing his hand, it's like they're making fun of him for how freaked out he is over, like, oh, are you still going on about that? That crazy guy who cut your hand?
Okay, so I was waiting.
Yes,
for this.
You're right. It does come to a point where, like, it's just down to Sally and Franklin. They don't know that their friends are dead yet, and they take like 5 whole minutes or something to just argue and whine about what to do next. And yeah, Franklin is probably at his most annoying.
But she's not. She's really
just
annoying.
He is at his most annoying just before he gets killed.
So in a way, that's, you know, a traditional slasher movie type thing, but it's also, you know, Hooper doesn't play it that way. I mean, you believe that Franklin is a real really annoying guy, and you still feel sympathy for him. And I mean, I think my thing was, when I was watching it, it's like, this is the guy you would want to die in the movie, but because it's so awful, you still don't even want Franklin to die. I mean, you know, it's too scary. You don't want Franklin. Which brings up the question of the blood on the side of the... Was that a mark? Was he marking them for later?
Well, I've always loved that because it's ambiguous.
There's so much that is, though. I mean, that's what's so nice about it is that...
The hitchhiker, after they throw him out of the van, he's running alongside the van, and his hand is still bleeding because he just cut it, and he makes this weird, like, it looks like a... the symbol of a cult or something, or like the mark of Cain or something. It's just this scrawl along the side of the van, but very deliberate. And then later,
and then Franklin, they refer to it like twice. Yeah.
Yeah. Franklin's looking at it going like, you know, do you think he's going to try to follow us now?
And
of course he doesn't have to, as it turns out.
Yeah. And then, so, well, the other thing is the hitchhiker invited them over for dinner. Like, mm-hmm. How is that going to work? I mean,
I don't know. I guess Hitchhiker thought that if he could get all those kids to the house, Leatherface could get them all at once, maybe.
But yeah, so, and then we kick off the, speaking of the house, the next section of awfulness, which is different from the first section of awfulness. I mean, it's, I think that even though it's not graphic, the gross out factor in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's a scene after she's been running and chased and beaten up. She finally, the Marilyn, what's her character's name?
Sally.
Sally finally passes out from shock at about the same point that I was ready to pass out from shock, which is when the previously assumed dead, decaying body of Grandpa starts sucking blood out of her finger. You know, we'd been introduced to the character, or the visual of the character.
Yeah, she runs through the house at one point while she's being chased by Leatherface, and while she's in the house, she finds a very obviously dead grandma, like, you know, skeletal, and what we assume to be the dead grandfather, but as it turns out later, nope.
No, nope. He's alive.
He's just pining for the fjords.
And it's so creepy. I mean, the makeup on it is so creepy.
Yeah,
and
the makeup's so eerily good too. I mean, it's really, because I guess the makeup is so like pancake and phony that it does look like flesh that's been dead for a while. So that when it starts moving, when something starts moving underneath,
and I mean barely any moving. I mean, yeah. The eyes never move. You never see Grandpa's eyes.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah, it's terrific.
It's just great. And I mean, what's so weird is that Leatherface is, you know, a slasher movie icon. Yet in this movie, he's not necessarily any more dangerous than anybody else in some ways.
You know, it's complicated. I mean, this was pre slashers as we think of them, pre Halloween by 5 years.
Yeah, it's nothing like Psycho in that there's one Norman Bates or something. It's more like Psycho in that there are 2.5 Norman Bateses.
Yeah, I mean people like to say Psycho. I mean, one of the big important things about Psycho is that it took horror out of out of Europe and its castles and curses and gypsies and brought it into America. But I mean, the Bates Motel, the Bates house that overlooks the motel is extremely gothic looking. It may as well be like a haunted castle on a hill, you know, but there's no mistaking the Chainsaw family's dirt poor farmhouse for anything but a poverty stricken farmhouse full of dead body parts.
Now, this is the one where there are all the cars, though, right? They find all the cars out back by the generator.
Yeah, they got all the cars.
Never explained. We never find out that they've been killing people. That's definitely the implication, but it's similar to the blood on the side of the van. I mean, Hooper doesn't take the time to do it.
The hitchhiker seems to have his own little quasi-religious rituals, like when Franklin won't buy the Polaroid,
he burns it. Yeah,
he burns it, which is like, I don't know. It's like laying down the gauntlet or something that he's going to kill. He's going to die now. He has to kill him.
But of course, the hitchhiker will never see Franklin again. Franklin's dead before the hitchhiker gets home. So it really doesn't even matter in some ways, though.
You know what? You could theorize that. He left it, I mean, you know, just for other family members to see, and like that is a mark, you know, that they that these guys should be slaughtered now.
Because, see, my only thing with that
because the gas station owner, Jim Seedow, who turns out to be part of the family later, he could have seen it.
He could have seen it when they pulled up, but he does everything he can to get them not to go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And I mean, it's this scene where you've got, he's like, you don't want to go there. You don't want to take the girls there. Don't do that. And it's like, and that's sort of one of the times where there's some implication of some, you know, sexual threat against the girls, which there isn't. And I mean, even later, the gas station owner is not, he doesn't ever kill anybody. he doesn't like that part. He just likes the meat. So, right. I mean, they're making the hitchhiker's making fun of him for it. So at that point, it's like, yeah, it's they're just stupid horror movie kids, but it's set firmly in reality where they're just stupid kids, and it's totally believable that these hippy dippy sort of, you know, twits would do this, and so then they do.
Yeah. You know, I think you can read. I mean, well, people have read a lot of political meaning into it, but I mean, I think a political reading of it is useful as far as seeing like noticing the generation, the generation gap in assumptions and attitudes between the kids who like feel totally comfortable knocking on a stranger's door and asking, you know, for gas or something, and even talking about like leaving their guitar as collateral. And Jerry's girlfriend goes, "They don't want your guitar, you know." Get real. The gap between that and, you know, the gas station owner who, yeah, he's part of the family, but, you know, despite or because of that, he's telling them the old fashioned wisdom of don't go messing around near other folks' property, basically. And
yeah,
they're just so young and idealistic that they don't ever think that there could be anything dangerous about anything, and they just walk right into their deaths.
And, of course, Franklin would be the one. That's the thing, is there are no voices of reason in the first 25 minutes.
Franklin's the closest thing because he's the one who got his hand cut.
But at that point, he just becomes even more annoying, so they all ignore him. And it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the ending.
Yeah,
which I'm sure we're going to have to talk about for a couple reasons. The next one isn't ambiguous. I mean, well, the beginning implies the world now knows about this terrible incident.
It opens with a news-like monologue that's scrolled in text with giving you the date of the alleged Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the names of Sally and her brother, and it's reading it like it's a true crime story, basically. Yeah, it even says, like, you know, these are the facts of the most bizarre crime in American history. And
so,
the film you're about to see is true, more or less.
We never get to see the end where the cops show up and do anything. And I mean, so, but we do get to see this sort of weird ending where she escapes. And then the hitchhiker gets killed.
And Leatherface is left screaming on the side of the road,
dancing,
throwing his chainsaw around.
Yeah,
yeah. It's supposed to be a dance of rage, which is a weird concept and one that's probably hard to convey when you're acting with a chainsaw and a mask that's supposed to be human flesh.
I mean, I kind of got that. I got that he was frustrated because, you know, his, what's it called, brother had died. But, I mean, that there's also no, we don't know how the family, who's the dad?
I think people have always assumed that Jim Seedow, the gas station owner, was the dad because he's obviously elder than the hitchhiker and Leatherface, but in the sequel, which Hooper made and which actually continues from the first movie, they bring back Jim Seedow and he refers to them as his brothers. So maybe he's not, I don't know if he was supposed to be the dad or not in the first one, but it's kind of, I mean, whether he is or not, the lack of a woman's touch in the family is very pronounced. It really really is just a boys' club. Just the dead grandmother upstairs, and it's just a family of men squabbling with each other.
Yeah. The squabbling is very disturbing at some point.
Yeah.
But
it's disturbing because, I mean, it kind of brings Leatherface down from the level of what we would later think of, you know, as like a Michael Myers or some unstoppable masked killer. He's just a dumb retard with with probably inbred family members who raised him that way.
Yeah.
It's really his fault. And the family members don't really know what they're doing. They can barely control each other. That kind of the fact that even the killers aren't in control makes the chaos of the movie even more frightening.
Yeah. The scene where Grandpa is supposed to kill Sally because the boys think it'd be funny. Grandpa keeps on dropping the hammer, and the assumption is that he's just too weak to hold it. But at this point, Grandpa is nonverbal. I guess the steady consumption of human flesh does that to you. But I assume he doesn't have teeth, so he must. But anyway, oh God. When I was watching it, there was almost she's begging for her life and not getting any sympathy from anyone. And I was wondering if Hooper maybe was making the grandpa somehow sympathetic. That he was not, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's so ambiguous and so, it's just so crazy that every time, even though, you know, she's running and jumping through windows and stuff, you're just watching it wondering how she gets the gumption to run that last time after the continued failures. And it's just because it's so horrifying. And
right.
Yeah. I mean, it's a rather unpleasant experience, but also one where the Hooper doesn't like glorify the unpleasant experience, which is very different from Hinkle's sequel remake where I guess 20 years has changed the genre enough to do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're right that, I mean, you know, obviously the Chainsaw was a landmark movie and Leatherface became an icon of the genre, but you know, it's because he only got lumped in with characters like Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger later after the fact, because they all came after him. And, you know, during the 80s, all the, you know, Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street and stuff were being sequelized, and they thought, hey, we could do sequels to Chainsaw Massacre. This could be a franchise. And the thing about Chainsaw is that it's probably, like, one of the worst movies to have ever tried to make sequels to and to carry on as a series, because, you know, it's such a singular thing. And the weird thing is that, like, there were three sequels before they remade it, before Michael Bay remade it in the early thousands. And, each one of those sequels kind of tries to deal in its own way with the fact that we really shouldn't be trying to make a sequel to the original. Because Hooper actually did Chainsaw 2 for Canon Films, Skull and Globus, and he did it as kind of a comedy, a black comedy, and he you know, amped up the humor. He made it cartoonishly gory. He brought in Tom Savini. So, you know, he very consciously made it a very different film from the first one, but still made it his and still put it in the continuity of the first movie and referenced the first movie and all of that and brought back Jim Sydow and stuff. But it didn't do too well in the theaters because it got released unrated by the MPAA because of the gore. I don't think it was in that many theaters. The next sequel was called Leatherface: The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, and it was from New Line, and that was in 1990, 4 years later. And the funny thing about that one is that it's a remake, but, like, because horror movies weren't being remade left and right in 1990, they called it Part 3, and they even have an introductory text, just like the first movie, actually tying it to the first movie, even though there's nothing in the movie to tie it from the first movie except for the general things of, you know, there's a Leatherface, and he's got a crazy cannibal family, and they live in Texas. So, you know, New Line was hoping they could turn that into their new Freddy, their new Nightmare franchise, and that didn't work. And so, like, a few years later, it's 1994, and it's the 20th anniversary of the original, and somehow, I don't know how the line, I don't know how the rights, well, I guess, you know, they, yeah, New Line sold them off pretty quickly, but this is before they were owned by, well, actually, it went back to New Line, because the Platinum Dunes,
yeah.
The remake was from New Line. I keep thinking it's from Platinum Dunes. Well, I guess it's co-production or something. But anyways, yeah, the rights slipped away from New Line just long enough for Kim Hankel to say, hey, I'll do one. And he actually wanted to make it like a, you know, the quote-unquote real sequel, even though Chainsaw 2 was a real sequel. But, like, he... Hankel actually intended for like the to bring back Jim Seidow from the first one and the Hitchhiker, and you can kind of tell like they're with their stand-in characters in the finished movie, like who that they were supposed to be those characters. Like the stand-in for Jim Seidow says, "Look what your brother did to the door," and Matthew McConaughey ended up playing the character who had to be rewritten from the Hitchhiker. And he cuts himself with a straight razor, just like the Hitchhiker cuts himself in the original. But, you know, the funny thing is, like, I remember the makers of Leatherface Chainsaw 3 said, like, you know, the second one was too funny. Like, it wasn't scary like the original. We're going to make ours scary. But, like, it's not scary, and there's also just, like, the new family that they create for part three is just like a bunch of goofballs. Like they just all have their own little ridiculous gimmicks and stuff, and they all just act real crazy. It's like they're all just doing variations on the Hitchhiker, essentially. And like, I don't really know how Hankel thought that this one, part four, was like more of a quote unquote real sequel to the original, because I mean, like three, it's a remake that still acknowledges the original movie, even though, you know, just to be a sequel, even though it's not really, it's more like a remake. And like, it's just goofy. I think he was going for something where it's like he thought that if his characters acted crazy enough, that would be, you know, that would be scary, because, you know, the crazy behavior of the family in the original is scary and unnerving. But, you know, it's like the behavior of the family in the original, like, it's actually kind of funny, I mean, intentionally, but it's because you've already seen all this awful stuff that, like, the fact that it's kind of funny makes it even, you know, creepier and weirder and scarier. So, you know, the problem with Chainsaw 4 is that it's not scary, and then, like, basically once Renee Zellweger really falls into the clutches of the new family, they're all just ridiculous, and you can't take any of it seriously. Because it's just McConaughey as this, you know, loudmouth psycho who never shuts up, and he's always ranting and raving and stuff. And his girlfriend, who's a real estate agent, and she kind of takes the role of being the person who the kids meet up with at first and then meet up with again later and realize that person's in cahoots with the family.
I'd never thought of her as the new cook before, but
yeah, well, she is. And then the guy who's supposed to be standing in for the cook, I mean, you can really tell that, you know, he was just supposed to be the cook again, the gas station owner, because like, he doesn't have a personality except for the gimmick that he quotes famous people from history.
No.
And that's it. And and then of course you got Leatherface, who has been reimagined as kind of a chunky transvestite. And it's true that, like, the original Leatherface, the Leatherface in the original Chainsaw does have a little transvestite streak in him. Like, he wears a woman's face mask at one point with makeup on it, and when the cook and Hitchhiker come home, he's almost acting like it's the mother figure, you know, or the berated wife or something. But in Chainsaw 4, they just take it all the way, and, like, he's always wearing a dress, and he's always wearing a you know, makeup on his mask, and he's always shrieking in a high-pitched voice. And it's not funny, and it's not scary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is Kim Henkel, you know how there are these people who make a movie, co-write a movie, something, and then they disappear? Mm-hmm. Not quite to the extent of, say, Terrence Malick, because people knew what he was doing, but like a co-writer.
Yeah.
Before this, were people wondering where he was?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, he hasn't really had a much of a filmography outside of Chainsaw. He's been a film professor in Texas for years, and I think he was at the time that he made this. So you know, his Texan credentials are all bona fide.
Okay.
But his filmmaking credentials, I mean, this was his directorial debut, and this is a really bad movie to make your directorial debut on. I mean, to be making your directorial debut and like touting it as, you know, finally the sequel fans that the original have been waiting for, you know, even though you're the guy who co-wrote it, you know, you're not the reason that it was what it was.
Right. I mean, I think that
you're actually less than half the reason. but you know who else is just like that is John Russo, the guy who co-wrote Night of the Living Dead,
right,
with George Romero. Like, they had a falling out, and they ended up like owning separate parts of, you know, the intellectual property of the Night of the Living Dead franchise, and that's why George Romero's sequels don't have the phrase Living Dead, and that's why Russo ended up producing some zombie novels and comic books and even the film Return of the Living Dead from Dan O'Bannon, which is a great movie, only came about because Russo and Romero split up, and Russo lived off the fame that Romero made, basically, with this half a story idea and the direction of the movie itself. And you know what? It's like, I mean, there's actually, the connection is even closer than that, because like this movie was intended to be called Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, just like Russo produced Return of the Living Dead. But you know, it was really dumb to still try to tie it to the first movie. What actually would have been smart is if, like, you know, the movie opened the same way that Return of the Living Dead opened, with the kids saying, like, hey, you know, you ever see that movie, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Did you know that was based on a true case?
Yeah, none of the kids in this movie are that smart.
Or likable.
No, and I mean, that was one of the things.
They're really obnoxious 90s kids. They're like the new breed of horror victims.
Yeah, and I mean,
who are even more annoying than like 80s slasher movie fodder.
Yeah, because there's no token black one. Though in Texas, that might have introduced a whole new element to it.
Ken Foray's in the third one.
Renee Zellweger, I think Maltin said that you can tell why Renee Zellweger went on to something, and she does sort of bring, there is an aspect to her performance where you're just kind of like, yeah, you can tell when she's in her scenes with the other three teenagers that she was the one who went to acting camp or whatever. But so basically you create these characters who you don't like, but again, probably unintentionally, even the most heinous of the characters, I don't even remember how he dies at this point. That really annoying one who lied about his dad being a lawyer and then a doctor and then he was a lawyer. How does he die?
He just gets hit on the head with a hammer.
There you go. Not
like
the
Bill
chainsaw. Not the chainsaw that he's so graciously
deserved. Well, no one gets killed with a chainsaw in this one. It's the only movie in the series where no one actually gets hurt with one. Also, it's the only movie in the series with like no even inference of cannibalism in it whatsoever.
No, they eat pizza.
They even go out of their way to show the real estate agent lady picking up pizza for the family.
Well, I don't think the real estate agent lady would have partaken, because she's not with them for...
But I don't know if any of them are anymore at this point. I mean, McConaughey references, you know, Leatherface needing a new skin mask that they're going to get from Renee Zellweger, but they don't ever talk about eating her. And there's body parts and stuff, but like the dinner scene that they copy, instead of having like a lot of, you know, human skulls and stuff sitting on the table, they just have a lot of dead bodies that have been like propped up, and you know, dead bodies propped up in the seats. And
yeah, I mean,
surely if they were cannibals, they wouldn't be letting those bodies just sit around and letting the meat get bad.
Seeing the production design on this one, the first one was an independent film in the 1970s, before you would have been able to scrounge up a, you know, people who had commercial experience, who had TV experience, which presumably they could do on this one, on Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So there, in my opinion, is no excuse for how crappy the house looks. They kind of have to get one set right, and they don't.
The dining room?
Well, just the entire house lacks any... It's not scary. It's like, they kind of give up. They're like, well, it's not going to be scary. We give up.
That seems like that whole that sentiment seems like it ran all throughout this movie, actually.
Okay, perhaps
because during the dinner scene, when like, you know, McConaughey's freaking out and just yelling at people and everybody's yelling over each other, it doesn't seem like any of these actors are on the same wavelength at all, or have any idea. They don't have any idea like how they're supposed to be playing off of each other, and you can just sort of imagine like Henkel, you know, trying to direct the scene, trying to think, like, you know, how do I I was actually on set when the original was made. How can I recreate some of this?
Yeah,
you know,
how did Toby do that? I can't remember.
How did Toby do that?
I probably shouldn't have said he didn't know what the hell he was talking about, huh? I mean, that's kind of the thing, is that, I mean, when you want to talk about a badly directed movie, this movie's really poorly directed in many ways.
And there's some flaws that like seem like they just weren't, like they should have been fixed in the writing stage but weren't, because a girl gets put on a meat hook in this one in reference to the original, and then like later inexplicably we see her crawling down a back road, and she gets discovered by a family member again, and it's like, where's the scene where she pulls her, where she lifts her, reaches behind her and pulls her entire body off of a meat hook? How did that happen? It's like they just needed one more victim, you know, and they decided to just reuse the same one. It's like, oh, shit, well, I can't go back now and write a whole new character in here. That
would have been the black character. See?
That car they were driving in could only seat so many people, you know. But I need another victim here. I'll just have the girl survive being put on the meat hook.
Yeah, and there's that scene, the dinner scene. At one point, I was thoroughly convinced Renee Zellweger was going to get up and walk out. When she tells them she's going to get up and walk out and not do anything, I didn't believe anybody was going to do anything. I thought McConaughey was going to stand there, sputter, and she was going to leave, and then they were going to have to go chase her down. And I thought it was going to bring back in her abusive stepfather and all that stuff. But then the movie sort of veers sharply in a different direction at that point.
The only really interesting thing about this movie is the ending, because the Illuminati shows up, and it's... I remember when I told you that before we watched this, you mentioned like, oh, that's kind of like how, you know, an Illuminati-like organization shows up in the Halloween franchise as being an explanation for Michael Myers' immortality and all that, but... You know, that's just sort of like a Gaelic Illuminati-like cult. This is the name brand Illuminati. I mean, there's even a joke in that Matthew McConaughey's truck says Illuminati towing on it. Right. And there's this scene where the real estate lady, McConaughey's girlfriend, says to Zellweger, like, you know, the real reason this is happening is because of the Illuminati, and she's like, ah, come on, get out. And then later, yeah, turns out that that's the case. Kind of the gist of what we learn when this Illuminati guy shows up is that, like, the reason that the Chainsaw family exists is because the Illuminati wants to, like, show, quote, show people the meaning of horror. And it's really odd. It's like this guy shows up with his driver. McConaughey's obviously scared of him. And he starts talking to Zellweger, and she's like, you gotta get me out of here. These people are crazy. And he's going, shh, shh, it's all right. It's all right. Everything's going to be fine. And then he starts getting angry at McConaughey and basically starts saying, like, hey, what's going on here? This girl should be more scared than she is right now.
You noticed it's Hellraiser hooks too, right?
Oh, yeah, and he's got, like, weird engravings carved into his skin around his stomach.
He previously had the Hellraiser box.
and in a weird way, it's kind of like the filmmakers are showing up. It's kind of like the filmmakers acknowledging to the audience that, like, their movie isn't very good and almost and kind of trying to make you think that the movie wasn't good on purpose because I mean it was definitely this he obviously had this ending in mind if he put Illuminati towing on McConaughey's truck. But basically, like, he, you know, the ending mirrors the original movie. Zellweger is chased on the roadside and gets picked up by a couple of vehicles, and the second one is the Illuminati guy again, and as he's, you know, driving her away from Leatherface, he says, you know, this was supposed to be a spiritual experience. This was supposed to be something really special, and, you know, sorry it wasn't. And she's just like, fuck you. But yeah, that's like that's, you know, the most charitable defense that you can make of this movie. If you really want to believe that it's bad on purpose, because that ending was in mind, is that, like, it's Henkel's way of saying, like, you know, the horror genre is dead and all the really scary movies have been made and we can just keep making all we can do is make sequels that will always be inferior now. And, you know, which is like a weird message to want to make if you're the one who actually got involved making one of these sequels.
And especially since, you know, it's not like Columbia, it's not like Sony put the money up for this. They bought it from, you know, they distributed it.
Pretty independent production,
yeah.
Actually.
So he took the time to do this and didn't fully commit to sort of that message, which is interesting that he would have taken the time to do it. And film professors, in my experience, always have a lot of good excuses for things they like. And so I would just love to hear Hinkle's audio commentary on this.
Well, actually, there is a, when I was doing research on this movie, there is a, like an hour long documentary that was shot on set called, like, The Making of the Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and you can buy it from, we'll put the link on the page for this, but someone actually did shoot interviews and stuff with Henkel at the time, so we can find out a bit of what he was thinking at the time. So far as, like, the Illuminati thing, the other thing I found of interest while researching this was that there was a book published just a year ago called The Illuminati Facts and Fiction, and where in one chapter the guy goes through all these pop cultural references to the Illuminati, and of course he brings up this one, and he actually talked to Kim Henkel here. This is The Illuminati Facts and Fiction by Mark Dice. I'll read an excerpt. During the course of my research for this book, I was able to contact the film's writer and producer, Kim Henkel, and on January 6, 2009, had a 31-minute and 13-second phone conversation with him about the film and his reasons for including references to the Illuminati. Henkel was a bit hesitant at first to give his reasons and wanted his audience to draw their own conclusions, but as our conversation progressed, he slowly revealed some interesting insights. Henkel revealed that others working on the film had urged him not to include references to the Illuminati and that they feared repercussions from the organization for doing so. Henkel included the references anyway and said that if the Illuminati in any form actually exists, he did not think that they would actually be concerned with him. Henkel did not appear to be very familiar with the Illuminati or its activities, but he said he chose the term for the film as a symbolic reference to any clandestine or wealthy and powerful group who participates in criminal activity or that exploit others for personal or professional gain. Emphasizing not to take any one interpretation of the reference or the activities of the Psycho family literally, he suggested as one possible interpretation that Mr. Rothman, which is the name of the Illuminati guy who shows up, was perhaps purchasing human flesh from Vilmer, who's McConaughey's character, and that Rothman was in turn selling it to others who enjoyed eating it and were addicted to it. And this is funny that Henkel offered this explanation to this guy since, like I said, there's no cannibalism references in the movie. He also suggested that the victims needed to be terrorized and put in an intense state of fear before they were killed so that the meat would contain high levels of adrenaline and other hormones, which the individuals who consumed it found appealing and addictive. While denying that the name for Mr. Rothman was inspired by the Rothschilds, Henkel did admit that he was familiar with the Rothschilds and that they were rumored to have been involved in the activities of the Illuminati. You know, so it's like Henkel wasn't even committed to the I'd always kind of hoped that like Kim Henkel was a true believer in the Illuminati, and that's why he put them in the movie, because like he wanted to get a message out about the Illuminati. And apparently, like, one of the, you know, many things that people accuse the Illuminati of in conspiracy theories is that they do have people out there on the payroll who are just, you know, like terrorizing innocent civilians to strike fear into randomly strike fear into the hearts of the populace. So like none of it is actually out of line, but he doesn't even commit to it himself. The last thing that's interesting about including the Illuminati at the end is that after Mr. Rothman takes Renee Zellweger to a local hospital, there's a cameo from Marilyn Burns, Sally, being pushed on a gurney by the guy who played Franklin. And they have eye contact and share a weird moment. And the cop who's talking to her, who was one of the teens from the original.
No, says, it was Grandpa without his makeup.
Oh, you're right. It was Grandpa without his makeup, which is a really pointless cameo. It's like, you know, hey, do you recognize that girl? You know, and, you know, this isn't the first time that something like this has happened before. And even the opening text in this movie, kind of in a tongue-in-cheek way, actually mentions the second and third sequels by saying, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre happened, and then 10 years later, a couple of, quote, minor but apparently related incidents happened. And then for 5 more years, there was silence until now. So, you know, the Illuminati, I mean, fans of these, there's really no one who's, I mean, there's really very few people who are fans of all the Chainsaw movies because they're all so different. But like for people who are fans of all of them and who want to think that they all take place in the same continuity, the Illuminati angle does offer a way for that to be possible by saying that the reason that there can be multiple crazy chainsaw families and multiple leather faces is that it's all an elaborate prank by the Illuminati to mess with people just for no reason.
Those dastardly Illuminati guys. I mean, and that's kind of the thing, is he lets her go to the hospital, and so then we get this conclusion, which it... I hesitate to want to give Henkel too much benefit of the doubt, because he still made me sit through this movie. I mean, this is the Alan Smithy podcast. He could have taken his name off of it, right? So he still did this to some extent. Let me think. Yeah, it's still lame in parts that you didn't have to make it lame in to get your point across.
It's a bit like, you know, when he was writing it and writing that ending, it's a bit like he was giving himself a safety catch.
Exactly, he was giving himself the film professor safety. Well,
if this movie doesn't actually...
I'm not naming any names because we've never looked into the legality of discussing things like this. There is a horror movie director who directed some very bad horror movie sequels for Dimension in franchises they had bought from other companies, whose wife was a film professor. And so we always wondered, I ran across I found out about this when I was working at a video store and she was a customer. You know, it's not like she hid that this was who her husband was. So what did she do in class when, you know, any knowledgeable film student would start snickering, you know, just like,
yeah.
just like it'd be a dare go up and ask her about her husband. I mean, you know, the guy's gone on to at least work on some decent TV shows, but he didn't direct them. I mean, and so it's just like, what did Hankel, did he leave himself an out? But the other thing is, what's his relationship with Hooper like?
I don't know. I mean, they were co-writers on Hooper's first movie, Eggshells, which was which actually has a couple of actors from Chainsaw. But then they didn't. Oh, and then they worked together on the script for Hooper's follow-up to Chainsaw, which was called Eaten Alive. And it's a very Chainsaw-esque movie. But then they didn't work together after that. So I don't know. I guess Hooper just, you know, tossed him aside once he started getting, you know, bigger offers, like directing Salem's Lot for TV and you know,
when Steven Spielberg called,
directing Poltergeist, yeah.
When Steven Spielberg called, he kicked him to the side.
Exactly.
Yeah,
You know what's really weird? There's a one of the things that Chainsaw 4 and 3 have in common is that even though the family is a brand new made up one, they still have a grandpa. And in Chainsaw 3, it's actually just a corpse, finally. But in this one, it's another old guy who actually, kind of like the original, you don't know if he's alive or not. But then suddenly he moves. right about the time that, you know, everybody's freaking out and stuff at the dinner scene, the grandpa in this one just, like, takes a knife and stands up and walks away from the table, and we never see him again. And it's like, did Hankel have a scene written where, like, Grandpa walks over to Zellweger with a knife and, like, cuts her finger himself to suck on her blood, like Grandpa from the original? I mean, maybe, but all that happens is he just gets up and walks away with a knife, and that's it. Really, really bad direction.
Yeah, I mean, the direction, I mentioned earlier, and you've hinted at it, how awful it is, but there are some shots in this, and I think we had talked at one point and said that the end sequence is probably the best directed part of the movie when they're outside on the road. But I mean, like, during the lengthy... I mean, the movie probably only runs, what, 82 minutes or something? Actually, I think this version runs long. I think it's like maybe even 100 minutes.
It's like 10 minutes longer.
Because we watched the Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre version, not the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, thanks to the internet. But anyway, the endless parts in the house, and that's what's so funny about the first one is that, you know, the first one has... basically Sally around the family a long time, really disturbing. In this one, it's gotten to the point where Hankel's doing whatever he can to make it disturbing, and it still isn't disturbing because
you can hear him off camera yelling, "Act crazier, act crazier, McConaughey,"
and
make some more crazy faces.
Yeah, and so, I mean, just that whole in-the-house sequence, it's just... There are parts in the movie that I think for about 10 minutes I forgot Leatherface was even in it.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing. Is that
and
like...
I think that was part of their point at one point, was that they didn't want to emphasize that angle of it or something.
It was sort of like Henkel resented even having to include Leatherface, and that's why he makes him a shrieking transvestite and allows Zellweger to actually shout him down at one point. Like, he gets up and he's like, she's like, you sit the fuck down, and he does. That's real scary.
You know what they should have done with this one if they really wanted to do this?
What?
I think National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I think they should have brought that element to this, and it would have been far more successful as crap.
I remember I read somewhere that, like, Henkel's initial idea for a sequel, like, back in the 70s, back when it was closer to the original, was that there should be a whole town full of crazy chainsaw people. And that definitely would have been more of a con- – it would have been like that Herschel Gordon Lewis movie, 2000 Maniacs or something. I kind of get the feeling Henkel had no problem. He probably thought all this stuff, all the humor was funny, and he kind of resented even having to have, like, chase scenes and scenes where people get killed and stuff, because those scenes are so incompetent. When people get killed in this movie, it's so badly done.
I mean, that's kind of the thing that, if film professors can always make excuses for things that they want to point out, so can low-budget filmmakers of dreadfully unfunny material. And, you know, big-budget filmmakers of dreadfully unfunny material. Just that's what DVDs have brought us, is just that, you know, I highly recommend some, you know, even if you've never seen the movie, you watch the special edition of, Return to Swamp Thing. And then you watch it with the commentary track, because the director is...
Jim Wynorski.
Jim Wynorski is an insane lunatic.
he thought he made a really fun movie.
He thought that Heather Locklear, he thinks she's better than Meryl Streep. He just loves her. I'm just like, because I was sitting there waiting for him to, you know, say how awful she was, because she's terrible in it. And he shoots off about how great she is, and I'm just kind of listening to it like, this guy's insane. I mean, there's just no other word for it. I mean, he's nuts. I mean, that, yeah, so, whatever.
Yeah.
But, I don't know if
A movie like this does make you wonder what its author thinks of it. And if this is really what they intended.
See, it's
a hard movie to pin down.
Clearly, this isn't what he intended.
Intentions were.
Clearly, yeah. This isn't what he intended, because he couldn't do what he... Well, I mean, we haven't heard why he couldn't get the original people back. It's not like they're busy.
Right.
To some degree. But
probably just wasn't going to pay him more than the scale. I think that's the reason Gunnar Hansen wasn't brought back on any of the sequels as Leatherface.
He wanted more than scale.
Yeah.
And so he just didn't work on movies.
So he just didn't do it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a movie you can't make a sequel to. But right. Then again, for what, 20 years, you would have said the same thing about Psycho.
Right.
But I think that in the case of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because it is
iconic.
Not that, just that it's iconic. It, you know, when Hooper made a sequel to it, he didn't sequelize the tone and sort of scariest experience alive thing.
Right.
Because, you know, you knew you couldn't do that.
Right.
And so, I mean, there's something about the sequel that you just can't do that. I mean, then the new ones, what is it? They've just got, the remakes are just lots of gore and lots of just terror.
And the tone is, like, you know, just excruciatingly grim and mean spirited.
So,
and not, yeah, and in a way that's mean spirited even compared to the original one, which is more just sort of like bleak, rather than mean. This one is mean spirited too, but
yeah,
it doesn't even have the conviction of its cruelty to like actually do anything that's really shocking.
At the points where Renee Zellweger is the, you know, toughest person in the house, it's like at that point the mean-spiritedness is just sort of there's nothing that they can do that would shock because there's no creativity to come up with anything. So yeah. One doesn't really have to worry about that aspect of it. So let's see, the ending. Yeah, I mean, what was I going to say? Oh, that sometimes we recommend the bad movies, but in this case, I mean, obviously I would never recommend Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre is, if you think you're going to have a problem with it, it's probably not something to, an experience to take lightly. Some preparation is involved, but I will say that I guess it's, well, we spoiled everything, so yeah. It'll probably still make you sick to your stomach, but, you know, not because it's gory. How's that?
Yeah, there you go. And it's just, oh, and it's incredibly well directed.
Yeah, and that's the other, yeah, so, you know, Hooper is basically gone and has been for 15 years from anything that's come out in a theater. Mm-hmm. Maybe even longer.
I think even longer. I think Carpenter had a theatrical release before he did. I mean, F had a theatrical release more recently than he did.
Yeah, I mean, and Hooper never really
like,
was
what,
able...
Was it The Mangler in 95? I think, wow, that might have actually been his last theatrical release.
Yeah, I mean, well, Hooper's getting... He's 67, so I guess he's... He did some of the Masters of Horrors.
He's done a lot of TV.
A lot of TV. Yeah, he had The Mangler. He did the Nowhere Man pilot. I remember that. He did Body Bags. That was with Carpenter, right?
Yeah, anthology movie.
Yeah, and I don't even know if that really got a real theatrical release. But
that was TV.
Yeah, so he's... some of it is that he's not really... It's not like Wes Craven where he's not really good at... I won't say that Wes Craven isn't good at anything. I'll say that Wes Craven tries more than he can... He bites off more than he can chew more often than not.
Uh-huh.
And that when he is successful, it's never a full success. Like
it has more to do with... Has more to do with good timing.
Yeah, and so, but Hooper, just looking at this, and I mean, I feel awful that we're talking about the guy, like, you know, but it has been, yeah, it's been 15 years since he had a movie come out in the theater. There's no excuse. I mean, the only thing I can think of is that he never could find a niche, a comfortable niche that, you know, allowed him to, because, well, no, actually, I'm looking at it. No, he hooked up with Canon, and they just chewed him up and spit him out. I mean, really. Spontaneous Combustion was out in the theater, though, right?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
No.
Yeah. Graham Revel does the music.
That's cool.
Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, I mean, he's a great director. I mean, that was like the thing of this, is that you watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre and you're like, well, of course Spielberg got him to do Poltergeist, because he's like Spielberg, only scary in terms of composition and feeling. I mean, it's like 70s Spielberg, only really freaking scary. So.
Yeah. And Kim Henkel has yet to direct another film, unfortunately. The only thing, probably the only other thing I'll ever enjoy from him is the screenplay to Danny Steinman's The Unseen, which I have yet to see.
So it is very unseen.
Very unseen, The Unseen.
Now, yeah. Danny Steinman, of course, is the guy who I couldn't believe ever made a movie before Texas or before Friday the 13th. But yeah,
yeah. You ever seen Savage Streets with Linda Blair? It's pretty entertainingly trashy. Got to give it that.
Oh, Stephen First is the Unseen. Well, there's something. Oh wow, Stan Winston did the. That is a lot of people on the story for the Unseen. But anyway, back to wrapping up Texas Chainsaw. I think we've.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that about does it. But yeah, see Chainsaw 1, see Chainsaw 2, because it's also from Hooper. Just know that it's a different tone. And don't see 3 or 4, unless you really want to like do some horror movie cultural archaeology and try to see how different people try to revive a franchise that never should have been a franchise in the first place. It's quite fascinating. Speaking of reviving franchises that should
okay,
be franchises,
there we go. Good segue.
Next episode is another horror movie special. But I don't think either of the movies are really going to be that scary. First, we're taking a look at the two movie series of An American Werewolf in London from John Landis, 1981, and 1997's An American Werewolf in Paris, which is apparently a direct sequel. It even references the events of the first movie. So, yeah, I haven't seen the movie in a long time. Looking forward to watching it again.
You mean London, right?
Yeah, London. I've never seen In Paris. I remember even at the time, it was like, even as a kid, I was like, it's just ridiculous that they're trying to make a sequel to that now. And like, and in 97, it was like, you know, who cares? I mean, if they made it, if it were now, they would just remake it. And they probably will be remaking it.
Yeah, I think they are. So, yeah.
But, yeah, back in 97, you know, if you wanted to cash in on the success of a horror movie, you actually still tried to make a sequel, even though it was way too late after the fact.
And it came out on Christmas, and
you didn't have any of the original cast or crew.
Yeah.
But yep. So An American Werewolf special next episode.
The Continental American Werewolf.
Oh man, I have a joke. This reminds. I came up with a joke about An American Werewolf in Paris years ago, and I just remembered it.
Okay,
now
go
I
ahead.
Have to, now
Do
I,
you have to
now
wait?
I have to say it.
Okay, go.
No, I can't. Okay. You know what the Ernest Hemingway actually wrote a werewolf novel while he was living in Europe. While he was living in Paris, as a matter of fact. Is called A Movable Beast. Is that Hemingway or Orwell who wrote A Movable Feast?
It was Hemingway.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, well, it works. There you go.
It's my American Werewolf in Paris literary joke.
Oh. How would he have known about CG? Okay. And so, yes, next time that will be, and we'll probably do them in chronological order.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, we have to. Because
I mean, how could you understand Paris without London?
Yeah, so next episode, we see London, we see France.
We see Jenny Otgutter's underpants?
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
All right, great.
All right.
So, for now, on Smithy Podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
It's barbecue time, and that means a trip to the home of Moore North, your barbecue headquarters.
This week's barbecue specials include delicious Eckrich Cheesy Cheese Franks. Just $1.19 a pound, quick and easy. They're great. They're super meaty, extra lean, fresh, never been frozen short ribs of beef. Just $1.59 a pound. And baby spare ribs, frozen perfect, in a 20-pound box, just $37. That's only $1.85 a pound.
Whatever your favorite barbecue, we have it in stock waiting for you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. This is Emma Riley. Good evening.